Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Audrey McGilkin Leadership Podcast. This podcast is dedicated to providing you with helpful insights from some of the industry's best and most respected leaders in the human capital space. I'm your host, Audrey McGilkin, CEO of Audrey McGilkin Talent Solutions. And today I'm thrilled that we're going to be joined by John Gleeson. John is president and CEO of A Better View. You know, I first met John a month or so ago when he presented an overview of design thinking. And as I sat and I listened to John, it really hit at me the opportunities that existed for leveraging the design thinking framework in the human capital space. As I really thought about some of the challenges that organizations face, it just really struck me that this could be something really impactful if we joined both of those up together. So I have asked John to join us in this session to share with our listeners a little insight into the design thinking space. But before we get into that, John, we would love to hear from you. Introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about what you do, and I'll hand over to you.
Thanks so much, Audrey. I'm touched and honored that you thought that I had something interesting to say. So thanks for having me today, and thanks for the opportunity to collaborate in the future. We'll tell our listeners a little bit more about that. A little bit about myself. I spent about 21 years at Procter & Gamble. I had a range of amazing experiences in the operations side of the business, in a sourcing and procurement space, as well as innovation and design at a time at P&G when design was trying to elevate the practice of design to be more of a strategic business competence versus a decoration station. And this was about trying to drive design principles into the DNA of the company. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we talk through design thinking principles. I left P&G about 12 years ago to form A Better View because I saw opportunities to help big companies elevate design as that strategic business competence. And I work with a lot of creative agencies, design agencies, innovation agencies, advertising agencies, as I found that they all sounded the same when they knocked on P&G's door. So part of it is how might we use design thinking or the user of these services as a way for them to become more relevant. And so I'm fascinated and inspired to try to help move this useful practice into the human capital space, because it is at its very core human-centered. And so I'm excited to talk about it and excited to help you translate this into the human capital world.
Yes, fantastic. You know, I'd love to just go ahead and dive right in, John. Design thinking isn't normally applied to the human capital space, and as you talked about, it's normally applied to designing products, innovation, and services. But I'd love if you could share, you know, what's been your experience about where have you seen this applied in the human capital space, and what do you think are some of the opportunities?
So Audrey, great question relative to who uses design thinking and where is it often practiced. It is certainly well known in the development and innovation of products and services, things that companies sell or offer, using the customer in many cases as the human center around which these solutions are created. But there's absolutely an opportunity to take that human-centered approach and apply it to humans in a human capital world, employees, customers, suppliers, leadership development, all these things. Think about the opportunity to create programs that are geared to inspire the individual and not only protect the enterprise. And so we'll talk a little more about the principles as we go through it. The other part of your question is, have I seen it in practice and where has it been applied? The very simple and easy one that I often see is the building or reconstruction of spaces inside of corporate enterprises. A lot of open office, a lot of wide hallways, a lot of large, wide escalators or big elevators to encourage human contact and interface. And a lot of companies are building inspiring spaces that attract people to come together so that they want to meet in this really inspiring open space. Certainly the newer companies, you see these Google and Facebook and other companies have these big gigantic auditoriums and even comfortable spacing, beanbag chairs and couches and things. And all of those things are an attempt at trying to be human-centered around how do I inspire these people to give 110%, 120, 150%, not just show up when they're assigned to show up and leave at the end of 8 hours. So there are lots of opportunities, and we'll talk a little bit more about different areas of human capital where some of these things might apply, whether it's succession management, whether it's talent development, whether it's employee engagement, policy implementation and development. You know, we can certainly use the principles of design thinking as a way of uncovering opportunities and then solving for that to create, at the end of the day, you know, greater productivity, higher engagement, open innovation that comes from the employees, as opposed to some of them feeling like they can't share what's on their mind. So there's a plethora of opportunities in this space. So I'm excited to try to share some of them.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, as I think about this, the notion of, you know, organizations really going after discretionary effort. So discretionary effort really comes from employees being inspired. It comes from employees feeling like they have joy in the workplace, however that's defined for them. And often when I work with organizations, I'll ask them to differentiate and really find where are the moments of truth. And I thought, I thought you shared an interesting example in some of our conversations that I'd love you to share with our listeners. And it was really about, you know, some of the moments of truth around onboarding. You know, when a new employee Yep. joins an organization, that's a moment of truth. And I'd love, John, to give you the mic back and have you share with our listeners just some of the examples that you've got in that space.
Well, the onboarding space is an incredible opportunity to, as the saying goes, you never get a second chance to make a first impression. And so, you know, I before we get into onboarding, I'll take a couple of steps even earlier in the process. If somebody's being recruited in, or the interview process, are they felt? Do they feel like they're welcome? Do they feel like there's a fit with that organization? Or are the people simply trying to tick a box? Oh, I've got this interview that's 45 minutes and I'm going to ask them a few questions. And is this really about also trying to sell the company? But the onboarding opportunity, think about many of us have had Apple products or have had, you know, other phone products that are really beginning to follow the lead of Apple. And Apple's quite known for their unboxing experience. Everybody knows when I open that little box for my iPhone, that I know what to expect, but it still seems to exceed my expectation with, oh my gosh, what's in here? And oh, isn't this thing elegantly presented? Well, why couldn't job offers be presented in the same way? Or why couldn't a preparation packet for my first day showing up in a company be prepared that way? Here's what to expect. And that onboarding process, that first day process, people thinking about what is that person going through? What apprehension? How are they nervous? They don't know anybody. They don't know where the restrooms are. They don't know where to park. Is there a way to think about their world? Because everybody else in the company already knows where to park, and they know where their desk is, and they know what to say when they check in at the front desk. But this person on their first day, they don't know those things. And a lot of times the company creates that onboarding experience based on the people who are already there not walking through that naive, nervous first day lens. So think about how might you use a human-centered process to create something that causes somebody to say, oh my gosh, I haven't even started. And they seem to love me and value me and they want me to succeed. And they've given me the keys to, you know, the map for the building, and they've made my onboarding easier, as opposed to putting all of the onboarding effort on me so that it doesn't have to sit on my managers. And so, you know, what if that creates that inspirational moment that says, I'm staying late today. And, you know, that discretionary time thing that you mentioned, it's those tiny little things that connect with a purpose and connect with the things that are important to me that inspire me to want to work harder and work longer and work more productively to drive value for this enterprise.
And, you know, that's exactly the feeling that I had when we first met each other and you first were talking about design thinking. I feel the same emotions that I felt then when you're talking about that example, which is really, how do you step in somebody's shoes for a moment? How do you walk in their shoes so that you can deliver the right kind of product or service or support? And that kind of leads me to this question of personas.
Yep.
And it was interesting. I was doing some other work the other day and I had used the word personas and somebody had said, well, that's a new one. And so I'd love if you could take a moment, John, to talk about in the moments of truth, how is that connected to personas?
Well, I'll tell you one of the things, Audrey, if I think back to my world at Procter & Gamble, it was very easy for a brand manager or an innovation manager or a product manager to sit in their cube and say, I already know what I need to know about my consumer. And some of it is valid and valuable because they've done research. And at Procter & Gamble, we created highly detailed personas in part to try to bring this target consumer to life. Who is she? What's her life like? And how might we at P&G, through the products and services that we offered, how might we make her life better? Because one of the underlying statement of purpose at P&G was about improving the lives of the world's consumers. And we'd be hypocritical if we weren't trying to help them live a better life, not just buy more of our stuff. And so the more you know about your target, your user, in the case of products and services, your consumer or your customer, in the case of your employee, I wonder how many companies have built personas that describe the different personalities and the different value systems that the range of their employees might use. A baby boomer from a millennial, a male versus a female, somebody that might come from a different country. And brings a different point of view and a different life experience to the work environment. And it's not just describing the physical attributes about those things, because, you know, millennials get a lot of attention today from corporations. And if you actually talk to millennials, one of the first things they'll tell you is, I'm not like the other millennials that you paint a brush as if we're all the same. And I think baby boomers would tell you the same thing as Gen Xers and Gen Zers and, you know, anybody else that might have a label. The reality is, one of the things we learned at Procter & Gamble and part of the way the tools we use to build our personas was, one of the things we learned was, what consumers say is often very different than what they do. And so if you have a focus group and you bring a group of consumers together, they're more likely influenced by not wanting to look stupid in front of other strangers, saying what they thought the company or the enterprise wanted to hear about certain products or services, as opposed to if you watch them perform those kinds of tasks in that environment, clean a bathroom, cook a meal, do laundry in the case of Procter & Gamble products. If you watched them perform those things, you'd often see things that they didn't talk about if you asked them to describe it. And I think the same is the case with employees. What workarounds have the employees created to manage a frustrating set of IT solutions or a certain time parameter that exists for a certain rhythm and cadence of things that happen in a business? And are they creating their own workarounds that by them, because they're working around it, that's ripe for an internal innovation to try to help make their world better? Whether it's a work environment or a chair that works or a computer that works or a phone system that works, or it's engagement and interaction that comes naturally as opposed to feeling like it's forced because there's a cross-functional initiative team that has to get together. And all of those things, I think there could be an opportunity for companies to use the idea of persona. I'll share a very extreme example at P&G. One of the ways that some of the brand teams would bring this persona to life is in some brand conference rooms, they would have a chair that had the name of that personified person. Joy is the consumer for this product category, and they'd always leave that chair open with a sign on the chair that says, "This is Joy, and we want Joy to be in the room every time we're talking about anything that has to do with this business." And others would have, you know, cardboard cutouts and other things as a reminder of who they really worked for. And they didn't work for P&G, they worked for Joy, or they worked for Sam, or they worked for Alice. And it was a way to bring that to life. And I think, you know, as cheesy as that might sound, I think there's an opportunity for human capital executives and leaders to think about who it is they're really serving, or chief executives for that matter. Who is it that they're trying to serve? You know, they're certainly serving an investment community, and they're serving an external, you know, community set of stakeholders. But a big part of it is they're providing the inspiration for the workforce. And is there a way for all of that to continue to be a reminder for who is it that we're really serving?
And the work, particularly most recently with some of the clients I've been working with, where we've been designing leadership journeys, they've thought a lot about the starting point as being the leader and what are the capabilities that the leader needs to develop versus why does the leader exist in the first place, which is to serve employees. Therefore, and we're going to talk about this in a second in terms of the five principles, really the starting point around empathy is really around the employees and not necessarily just the leaders who are going to be part of this journey. And so it's a really fascinating way of shifting your thinking around some of the big areas of human capital. But even although we're getting very excited about the topic and we could be on here for a long time, I am going to ask you to could you share with our readers the model or framework that you use to think about design thinking? Because for some people, when I talk to them about design thinking, they'll say, well, what is it? And what is it really? And how do you describe it? And I've heard you do this a number of times, John, very elegantly. Well, and so I'd love if you could share that with our listeners in terms of, you know, how do you think about design thinking?
Well, one of the wonderful and sometimes potentially confusing things about design thinking is design thinking is a very inclusive process. And as a result, there are lots of people that want to put their thumbprint on what they believe design thinking is. And so as a way of grounding, I tend to use the design thinking model that came out of the Stanford D School. And it has five principles to it. The first is empathy. The second is define, or I often use the term framing. And the third is ideation. The fourth is prototype. And the last is test. And I'll touch briefly on each of them. So empathy is, as you mentioned, Audrey, empathy really is about, do you really, really know and understand the people you're serving. And this isn't a cursory, you know, in the consumer products world. Oh yes, she's 29 to 54 and she has a household income of X and she has 2.3 kids and she drives a minivan. This really is about, what does she want from her life? And how might our thing help her achieve those things? And I think in the human capital space, the same kind of mantra could exist is the people that come join this enterprise. Why have they come to join? Why do they stay? What inspiration do they get? What frustrations do they experience? What challenges, what barriers do we as leaders put in front of them? And do we have visibility to those things? And empathy really is about, it's about discovery. You use the term leadership journeys. One of the tools that's often used at the empathy stage of design thinking is a customer journey or a consumer journey or an operations journey. Whoever it is you're trying to solve for, do you know enough about the thing you think you're trying to solve? And what are the experiences? Do they create, as I mentioned earlier, have they created workarounds to solve some problem that you thought you had solved, but it doesn't work very well for them? You know, one of the examples I often use is the IT organization in a very large company spends a lot of time making sure that software will work and integrate with each other. But as a result, it often, for some people, it might take 20 minutes to boot up a computer in the morning. So they come in, they sit at their desk, they boot the computer, and then they walk away and start talking to other people, and they get coffee, and they get the mail, and all of those things that may or may not be productive based on what they're doing in that spare time while the computer gets ready to be used. And does the IT organization understand that? You know, if they're about productivity, do they understand that the first 20 minutes of every employee's day has nothing to do with the computer other than to avoid it? and so part of that is they're doing a great job bringing those systems and tools to the workforce, but are they really understanding how people are using them? The second principle of design thinking is this define or framing stage. And there's a very simple question that I often ask when I'm asked to come in and assess or coach leaders with respect to design thinking. And that is, what problem are we trying to solve? And then the other part related to empathy is, for whom? And a lot of times, the business, because business is trying to run fast and efficient, and the perception of efficient is, you know, we're going to skip a lot of steps and just get to, here's what we think the problem is. And a lot of times, companies are geared to try to solve first and then figure out, did it work or what was the problem? And the challenge is, if you begin to solve too soon, before you really understand who you're trying to serve, before you understand what problem you're trying to solve, that you may inevitably come up with the wrong solution or the right solution, but not as effective as it might have been. And so framing really is about trying to understand the context of the consumer, their frustrations with respect to products, or in the case of human capital, you know, a leadership development program. How do we identify those stars that we want to continue to support and advocate for? How do we find that rough nugget that may not be a star yet, but they have some really interesting attributes that we might be able to leverage in a different way, as opposed to everybody has to be at a cookie cutter kind of job with a cookie cutter job description? And how do we leverage those talents? And that's where the framing opportunity really is about. Do we really understand what it is we're solving? Are we solving for a symptom? Attrition. Or are we solving for the root cause of attrition? And so, you know, in succession management, are we moving the right people to the right places to solve the right business challenge? as opposed to, well, you know, they've been here 20 years and it's their turn. And there are pros and cons to all of those choices. But part of that is, are we putting the human at the center? How do we inspire them to deliver the most so that they then deliver the business result? The third stage is ideation. This is one that so many people are very familiar with respect to brainstorming processes and different ways of bringing ideas to the table. There are some new things with respect to design thinking about how to do ideation. But this is one that a lot of people kind of have the idea of what bringing new ideas are. But all of those ideas should be centered around the prior two stages of discovery. Who is it and what is it that I'm trying to solve? And then the ideation should be focused against those things and not a random selection of really, really brilliant creative ideas that may not have relevance to the business. Prototyping is one of the things that I think a lot of big companies, this is the fourth stage in the of five of the design thinking principles. Prototyping is probably one that most companies have the hardest time with, because so many companies, at least the ones that I've had the chance to work for and the be blessed to serve in an advisory or consulting role, most companies want to have the perfect solution and then launch it. And a lot of times they wait and they wait and they wait and they refine and then they launch it with something that they think is perfect, as opposed to launching smaller versions of that earlier and using that as a learning platform. And one of the reasons that a lot of companies, particularly larger organizations, struggle with this is the annual performance review as a way of measuring people's performance often punishes failure. And the idea of prototyping is, I'm intentionally going to put something that isn't perfect out into the world somewhere. It could be small. And I know it's not perfect, but I'm going to learn more from that than if I wait and wait and wait and wait and then put the perfect solution in, which inevitably is still not going to be perfect. And so a lot of companies struggle with this. Startups are really good at this because that's their nature. I'm going to put something out into the market and use it. IT companies, tech companies are really good at this because if you're searching for a flight on Expedia, you don't know that they changed three drop-down menus and they're trying to test, did they find it? Did it work? And they often have multiple versions of that out in the world that we as consumers don't see. And the idea of doing prototypes or experiments, if you will, with humans in an employee, it scares a lot of people. But this is one of those that if you try it and you get the employees, in the case of human capital, the employees to be a part of the experiment, as opposed to just being the silent guinea pigs, then you can openly activate a feedback loop that may actually provide more value, not just for the thing that you've launched, but an idea loop or a suggestion box that may actually feel like it's going to get some action. And then the fifth and final principle is to test. This is, did it work? Did it not work? What worked about it? How might we learn from it? And all of this is intended to be an iterative set of loops, that what didn't work, oh, maybe what we learned at empathy wasn't the right target, or maybe the problem we were trying to solve at the framing stage wasn't the right problem. And so all of that is test. And then the other side of it is, if it did work, what value did it create? Do we have measures? Do we have metrics? In the case of new products, did it grow the business? Did we access new consumers that had not used our products or services before? And similarly, in a human capital space, did we inspire and engage people? Or did something we put out there turn people off and cause them to think about, you know, other employment options or other departments inside the company? Did we set up a leader not to be to truly inspire and lead? Or did we set them up to manage against a set of activities?
This is fantastic. I love that you've shared your perspective and your insight, and I hope that our listeners are as inspired as I was when we first connected. You know, often what I find when I talk to HR leaders or executives is really this notion of tactical is driving out the strategic, and the urgent is taking over the important. And I think that, you know, leveraging this process of design thinking is really a way for leaders to take a step back from the day-to-day and really start to think strategically about human capital. And I think that's why I was so inspired and really love this notion of design thinking and human capital together, really just creating a fantastic solution, particularly for HR executives that are weighed down by urgent things every single day. And so one of the things we haven't shared with our listeners yet is that you and I are going to be hosting an innovation lab together here in St. Petersburg in Florida. It's going to be on the 10th of January, and it's going to be at the Rays Stadium here in St. Pete. So you're going to be hearing more from John and I if you're interested in attending that session. Please email me at audrey@audreymcgucken.com, or you can email our Chief Client Officer, erica@audreymcgucken.com, to learn more about our Innovation Lab. But in the meantime, over the next few weeks, I'm thrilled that John is going to hang with us a little bit longer, and we are going to do a deep dive into each one of the principles of design thinking. So if this was inspiring for you, if it piqued your interest, then more to follow. John, any final comments for you as we wrap up here?
Throughout this entire podcast, this opportunity for design thinking, I think one of the things that I see even in the product and service space is the lack of focus against this user, this consumer, and use the consumer as the ultimate filter for the things that we might put into place. So you talked about urgent versus important and strategic versus tactical. You can't have great execution if you haven't thought through it strategically, but conversely, if you haven't thought through how it is you're going to put a policy in place or inspire employees in a new way. And I think if everybody that's listening, I hope many of you will come to the Innovation Lab, but if you put the employee or the group of employees at the center of your filter for the solutions you put into place, I think you all can be slightly better off. You know, what are we trying to do to serve them? What are we trying to do to enable them? What are we trying to do to inspire them? Instead of, we've got to institute a policy, or we can't do that with 100,000 employees. Well, think about a high-performance work system. If you provide the system with the principles and they believe in them and they understand the purpose and they understand those things, they begin to self-regulate. And so to a degree, design thinking already exists in the human capital space in those places that are operating in a high performance way, because they've got systems and processes and principles in place. But this is, I'm really excited about the opportunity to share more. And again, hopefully some of you might be able to join the Innovation Lab in early January.
Yeah, I'm excited to roll our sleeves up and really work collaboratively with the folks in that Innovation Lab. It's going to be very exciting. Thanks again, everyone, for listening to this episode of the Audrey McGucken Leadership Podcast. Until next time, and we will talk to you then.